Hi, everybody. Geraldo here. Welcome to Geraldo Rivera, the podcast. If this is your first time listening, thank you very much for tuning us in. Every week or so, I'll give you my thoughts, my opinions on the air, on the latest news. There's so much to talk about now in the age of Trump. You can have show notes if you need them. They can be found on my website, geraldo.com. Come back often. Feel free to add the podcast to your favorite RSS feed. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also follow me on Twitter at Geraldo Rivera and on Facebook, Geraldo Rivera. All these links are in the show notes. Again, thanks for tuning us in. Here now the show. Hi, everybody. It's Geraldo Rivera. This is the podcast, February 21st, 2017. Today, the topic is immigration, specifically undocumented or illegal in some characterizations, illegal immigration, and what President Donald Trump intends to do about it. The news, I think it's fair to say, is not good. It looks like the rubber is about to hit the road on this very, very emotional issue. It sounds, to start small, I want to start with how it has affected me and my relationship here at Fox News. When I came to work here, shortly after the 9/11 attacks, I was a senior war correspondent and immediately was sent out to Afghanistan and in 2003, Iraq, after the invasion under the Bush administration, the invasion there. So most of the first 7 or so years of my time here at Fox, I was the war correspondent. Everybody was on the same page. Everybody was rooting, obviously, for the same conclusion. We wanted victory. We wanted, even more important than victory initially, at least, we wanted very much to get our revenge on the lowlifes who had attacked us and taken out so many innocent lives. So for those 6-7 years, my first 6-7 years at Fox, everything was hunky-dory between me and the audience. Then an incident happened in Virginia, around Virginia Beach. I remember very clearly an undocumented immigrant, an illegal immigrant, or in the harshest characterization, an illegal alien. And believe me, I hate that expression. It makes them sound like they come from outer space. Anyway, an undocumented immigrant without a driver's license, drunk, hit and killed a pedestrian in Virginia. So to Bill O'Reilly, my longtime sparring mate and someone I've known for 20 years or more, Bill O'Reilly and I really went at it arguing. O'Reilly thought that the issue was an issue of immigration. And I said, no, the issue is an issue of drunk driving. This is one of the, 35,000 fatalities in the United States caused by drunk drivers. And O'Reilly said, no, this is about an American life, an innocent American life being claimed by someone who had no right to be here. Therefore, it was an immigration issue. I mean, this is basically the same classic structure of the debate O'Reilly and I later had regarding the tragic murder of Katie Steinle in San Francisco by an undocumented immigrant who had come back after being deported 5 different times. Is it the act of a murderer, or is it the act of an immigrant? Is it an immigration issue or is it a crime issue? And since immigrants, particularly the undocumented immigrants, and this is documented and it is beyond debate, since they commit crime at a lower rate than either legal immigrants or citizens, I argue that to conflate undocumented immigration and crime is really unfair. It's an anecdote. And if you're going to talk about the drunk in Virginia who claimed that innocent life, the drunk driver, then you should talk about the 10,000 incidents where the undocumented immigrant went to work, took his kids to school, went to the grocery store, cleaned up the sidewalk, took out the garbage. I mean, if you're going to talk anecdotally, and since they commit fewer crimes than documented or citizen Americans, then fair's fair. Let the world know that as undocumented immigrants move into a community, generally speaking, the crime rate drops. Anyway, O'Reilly and I had this really impassioned debate. It's on the internet. You can look it up. 2007. And I was sure I won the debate. I was positive that the force of my reasoning had convinced everybody in our audience that this was indeed an incident involving a drunk driver rather than an immigration incident. So I was semi-surprised, I guess, when my social media, to the extent it existed at all in 2007, certainly my emails and my text messages, were bombarded by members of the audience who had seen the confrontation between me and O'Reilly and thought that O'Reilly kicked my butt, that I was absolutely out to lunch, that it was all about immigration and not about crime or drunk driving in this case. I argued, and I finally wrote a book about it called His Panic, Why Americans Fear Hispanics in the U.S., Hispanic immigration, as the percentage increases, and it's really increased exponentially. I talked about what people really fear isn't the undocumented immigrant, it's that the country itself is changing. There are far more Latinos now than ever there were before. Now, we Latinos, we Hispanics, are almost one out of every five Americans. I'm talking about citizens now. We're 18% of the U.S. population, the citizens, the legal residents, 18%. And that, I think, is what generates, what motivates this fear. People hear Spanish being spoken in the bank or the supermarket or wherever they really, it really turns them off. So that's what I think is really going on. It's a kind of xenophobia, but there is a racial aspect to it. I want to get further into that because I also think that that is part of what motivates some of the loathing toward the refugee and the Arab immigrant population. But I just want to remind everybody that up until 9/11, I talked about how I came to Fox shortly after 9/11, up until the 9/11 attacks, the southern border was very seldom on people's minds. Every 20 years or so, 1954 under President Eisenhower, 1986 under President Reagan, it came back into the public consciousness and became an issue. But generally speaking, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of mostly Mexican in those days, now Mexican, Central American immigrants would flow informally into the country whenever there was a demand for them in this country, whether they could find work in agriculture, whether they could find work in, domestic employment, whether they could find work in lawn services or dishwashing and so forth. They would come and they would go, and the demand lessened, they would go home. For instance, whenever there was a war, Vietnam, good example. All of the able-bodied Americans were off to Vietnam or Korea or World War II. They left behind a vacuum in terms of jobs, and the undocumented immigrants would come informally and they'd fill those jobs. So when it happened this back and forth across the southern border, really, and nobody gave it much attention until the 9/11 attacks. Then suddenly this border, and remember, I have to remind people, men my age who hail from the South, they remember the antebellum South. They remember the pre-Civil War South with great nostalgia and fondness, and they think about the Civil War almost. It was a big article today or about the new book, Divided Nation, about how, we never really recovered from the Civil War. But the Civil War is alive and well. Why do I mention the Civil War? Civil War started 1860, 1861 to 1865, just 15 years before the Civil War happened. 15 years. Many of the generals who served in the Civil War 15 years before as younger men, as lower-ranking officers, served in the conflict known as the Mexican War, 1846. That war resulted in the southwestern part of the United States going from Mexico, from being part of the Republic of Mexico. We conquered it. And we created the states of Arizona and New Mexico and Colorado and California and Oregon and the rest. That was all Mexico. So the people are sneaking back across the Mexican border are people whose ancestors may have lived in the United States before the border moved over them. So, you know, there's this strong historic logic to the informal Mexican immigration over the border. Then 9/11 happens, going back to my point. 9/11 happens, and what does the United States do? We did the same thing we always do when we're attacked from overseas. We hunker down. We've talked about border security. And we enormously enhanced the ability of law enforcement in the United States to prevent bad people sneaking into this country. So even though, where did the rubber really hit the road? Even though there has never been a verified terrorist penetration of the southern border. Not one time by an extremist Islamist. Not one time has one been verified, a terrorist coming from the south to the north. Still, that's where, I use the expression rubber hits the road. That's where the lion's share of our border security resources were devoted. It was devoted not to going after Ahmed, who took out the World Trade Center, but going after Juan and Maria, the avocado pickers, the poultry processor, the meat packer, the babysitter, the lawnmower. They're the ones who really paid the price in terms of degree of difficulty in getting in. So the informal arrangement, the ebb and flow across that southern border, that was eradicated in the 9/11, post-9/11 era. And for years, we've struggled with what to do about the people who, many of them were stranded here by better border protection because they didn't want to go back. They knew they'd never be able to get back if they did leave voluntarily. So this has become an issue that swells up every once in a while. And under Donald Trump, that arc that began around the time of my great debate with Bill O'Reilly in 2007. That arc took us from a time in 2007 where there was great promise of immigration reform and a liberalization, particularly of immigration across the southern border. And there were proposals in the Senate. It was passed in the Senate. Passed Teddy Kennedy, John McCain. They got together. They drafted a bill. Immigration reform, comprehensive immigration reform, blocked by the GOP and the House of Representatives. So 2007, when it looked like everything was going to be, moderated with immigration reform, 2007 until 2016, and the current president's campaign for the highest office in the land, immigration became the biggest issue, the most egregious issue, the most impassioned issue. All of that passion that O'Reilly and I demonstrated in that fist fight we had on the air in 2007, the verbal fist fight, that became how people spoke of immigration, generally speaking. Generally speaking, you were either for strict border control and the expulsion, the deportation of the 11 million undocumented immigrants here, or you were for some reasonable approach, something like President Obama demonstrated when he passed the so-called deferred action against the deportation of immigrants, the DACA, the DREAM Act program. DACA, the kids were brought here without any fault of their own by their parents as youngsters. Anyway, I'll get into that, the DACA program and the DREAM Act more specifically. But my point is, Donald Trump is president today because half this country was so aggrieved by liberal immigration policies under Obama or anybody else that they thought that immigration was the most important issue facing the president. As in Brexit in Britain, as is going through Europe today with all of the debate about their refugees and the immigrants that are coming and going into Europe. But for immigration, Donald Trump would not be president. But for the importance of this issue, my friend Donald Trump would never have won the 45th presidency. So we've been waiting because he made such a big deal about fighting illegal immigration and deporting many of the 11 million who are here. We have been waiting for him, for the president, through the Homeland Security Agency, to issue his guidelines for individuals in this country illegally. Would he, as President Obama did, prioritize, for instance? Would he aim most of the resources of the Border Patrol and the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, toward the felons, the gangbangers and so forth? Or would he more generally use those resources or really greatly expand them to go after all 11 million? So now he's issued the guidelines. So what are the guidelines? What do the guidelines say? The guidelines really don't give any comfort to 85, 90% of those in this country without proper documentation. The guidelines say that any individual in this country illegally is ripe for deportation if they've been convicted, if they've been charged, or they've been suspected of a crime, which could include traffic infractions. Worse than the fact that it could include traffic infractions is the fact that the very act of coming here is a crime. Particularly if you've come here before and been deported and come back, then it's a serious felony. Or if, as many of the undocumented do, you used as an undocumented immigrant, an unlawful or illegal immigrant, you used a fake Social Security card. That's a felony. What people don't appreciate is that if an undocumented immigrant uses the fake Social Security card to get a job, they are paying Social Security tax. They are making a gift to the United States Treasury. Why is it a gift? It's a gift because they're putting money into the Treasury via their Social Security taxes that they have no hope of ever retrieving. They'll never get that money out. It's a fake account. So it goes to the Treasury, billions of dollars. It's a gift from the undocumented immigrants. Everyone's talking about how Trump says he's going to throw out all the undocumented immigrants who are on welfare. That's people who are taking from the Treasury. I understand how that irks people. But if that irks you, in fairness, shouldn't you also be irked by the fact that these undocumented immigrants are paying from their hard-won earnings, their wages, they're paying Social Security tax, and they'll never collect Social Security because they're here undocumented or unlawfully? So anyway, these new guidelines from President Trump, they really will greatly expand the number of people living in this country illegally or unlawfully or without proper documentation who are considered a priority for deportation. The one exception, the 15%, 10-15% of the 11,744,000. 744,000 of these Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, DACA, these Dream Act students, they will be protected from deportation. They were by President Obama's executive order. They have been worried sick that they will be undone by President-elect Trump. And now he's saying that, you know, he has a heart, and he does. I know the guy. He has a heart, and he's not going to prioritize the DACA kids. Kids brought here by their parents at a young age through no fault of their own. If they've led respectful, law-abiding lives. I mean, if they've committed a crime, then, if a Dream Act student becomes a gangbanger, then that kid is going. My problem is, and this is a real problem, I believe that this new approach, these guidelines, these toughening, these anybody that commits any kind of crime, including the crime associated with your being here unlawfully is now going to be deported. This is going to result in mass deportations, massive deportations. And I mentioned Dwight Eisenhower in 1954. That was the Operation Wetback. Operation Wetback was the last time we had military-style roundups that expelled hundreds of thousands of immigrants, in that case, Mexicans. That was back in 1954. And it really was a wrenching experience for the United States. It reminded a lot of people of the Japanese internment camps. Japanese was even worse. They were citizens who were interred. The Mexicans weren't citizens. They were here without proper documentation. Although many of them were citizens of the United States, caught in the big roundup, and then expelled. Hundreds of thousands of them in 1954. It was a convulsing experience for the country. And it looks like it's heading back that way. If you define undocumented immigrants that you are prioritizing as anyone who committed any crime, then you're basically talking about anybody but the DREAM Act kids. So how are you going to do it? How are you going to round up 10 million of the 11 million, let's say? How are you going to round them up? Over the last couple of weeks, we've watched on the news as ICE agents have mounted raids on undocumented immigrants, allegedly targeting gangbangers and violent felons. 680-odd have been arrested and held and presumably are on their way back home wherever they came from, Mexico or Central America, mostly. You've heard about it on the news. You've seen the agony. You've seen the demonstrations. And that is for 684 people. Imagine when it's for 10 million people. It's going to be a repetition of those scenes you saw a week or so ago. The ICE agents, heavily armored, going into communities, sweeping up people, taking them out. And what happens under these new guidelines? When you go into a house to get the felon, all right, Jose is the gangbanger. He's in MS-13 or something. And then you find Jose's brother, his cousin, his parents, and none of them have documentation. Under these new guidelines, they can all be rounded up. They will all be expelled because they're in the country illegally. The new guidelines state that they will not distinguish. Now, maybe if there's a DACA kid there, they will cut the kid some slack. Maybe. What are you going to do, 16-year-old kid? And your parents get thrown out. Your older siblings get thrown out. Your cousins get thrown out. You going to stay on your own? What's going to happen? What's going to happen is it will be impossible. I don't care if he adds 10,000, 15,000 border guards and ICE agents to the effort. It's going to be impossible for the feds to do it on their own. They're going to need help from local law enforcement. That's the only way to do it. This is massive. 10 million. 10 million. I'm assuming that the 1 million, the DACA kids, will be cut slack. So 10 million, that's bigger than the population of New York City is 8.5 million. 10 million, imagine rounding them all up. What are you going to do, put them all on buses? What are you going to do, walk them to the border? Or if they come from Guatemala, you're going to send them back to Mexico? Because they came in through the Mexican border? It's going to be a big, emotional, traumatic mess. And those local law enforcement agencies, guess what? They're not going to cooperate, many of them. None of the big cities. Chicago's not going to. Chicago has actually adopted an ordinance, a law, that bars county cops and jails from detaining unauthorized immigrants to be turned over to the feds. They have a law against it. The feds don't have a specific warrant with Jose's name on it. You're not going to get him because we're not going to tell you we have him. It's going to be the same thing in New York. It's going to be the same thing in San Francisco. It's going to be the same thing in Los Angeles. It's going to be the same thing in over 300 American cities. Now you have entire states that are picking up on this whole idea of sanctuary states, Colorado, Rhode Island, California. A lot of states are just saying the whole state is a sanctuary state. And then when the universities get involved,
and the churches and the synagogues. This is going to be a convulsive kind of effort. I use that word because I want you to understand that I really think that the effort will not be worth the result. And what's going to happen is there's going to be a real schism in this country. And I do believe, and I've mentioned this before, that the whole issue of sanctuary cities will be the great dividing line between blue and red. Be the great front line in the battle and the culture war that is coming. So what do I think of the president's plans? I think that, you know, I am enormously sympathetic, not only to the undocumented immigrants or the Latino community, but to everybody who really worries about this. I think it's ironic that the vast majority of people who are most fervently opposed to undocumented immigration are people who've never seen an undocumented immigrant in their life, never had any kind of, you know, interface with an undocumented immigrant. People from Iowa in the middle of the country, they don't know an undocumented immigrant from a man in the moon. But they complain and are most emotionally moved by the whole issue. But I think that this is going to be very, very difficult for the president. I think that his plan is definitely more aggressive than President Obama. And President Obama, remember, was the deporter in chief. President Obama rounded up and deported 2 million undocumented immigrants over his 8 years. 2 million of them. Donald Trump is 684. So President Obama, with a compliant press, media that really thought that his poop didn't stink, he was still called deporter in chief and was roundly criticized by many Latino leaders. Donald Trump won't even get that slack. They're going to condemn everything he does. The sanctuary cities are going to sue everything he does. This new refugee ban, which I think is reasonable, at least it's constitutional, put it that way, is going to get sued just like the other one was. Maybe he'll win, but this is going to be a very, very, very big and very emotional issue. And when you start seeing families split up and kids here and parents there and all the rest of it, and these are people that have not been convicted of a serious crime, who are not a threat of national security. It's not just focused on people who've just gotten here. It's not just focused on people who are close to the border anymore. But you can just go and round up anybody you want and say they're criminal aliens because obviously they're criminal because they got here without proper documentation. I think that it's going to cause tremendous friction between the president and the Latino community. I'm very glad that he has that one Latino, Alexander Acosta, now Secretary of Labor, in his cabinet. Maybe he can help modify some of these tough new rules that the president has now decided to implement. But it's going to be a very, very rough time. On my final note today, February 21st, 2017, I want to talk about President Trump and the Jews. I am a proud Jurican, as you may know. And the president has been weird about anti-Semitism, hasn't he been? I mean, honestly, even if you love the guy, I do love him. He's a great guy. And, look, his daughter is an observant Orthodox Jewish woman now. His grandchildren are Ivanka's kids are Jewish. The president, I think the president probably interfaces 80% of the people he meets and talks to are probably Jewish between the Upper East Side of Manhattan and Palm Beach. Everybody's Jewish. But he hasn't sufficiently condemned anti-Semitism in specific terms. He's been given plenty of opportunities. I mean, most notoriously, that press conference, that rambling, hugely entertaining press conference last week when the Jewish fellow wearing the yarmulke got up to ask about anti-Semitism, and the president must not have heard the question correctly, but he perceived that he was being attacked on anti-Semitism, and he went off and said how he's the least anti-Semitic person in the world and all the rest of it. I think he probably is the least anti-Semitic person. That's why I'm baffled that on National Holocaust Remembrance Day, he didn't mention the fact that 6 million of those Holocausted were Jewish. He didn't mention Jewish at all on Holocaust Remembrance Day. Anyway, I think he made up for it today. He went to the National Museum of African American History and Culture And he was very, very respectful. Very respectful of the museum, its exhibits. He condemned bigotry, intolerance, hatred in all forms. He said that the museum really helped to capture and preserve a very, very horrifying chapter in American and world history. But he was asked appropriately about the anti-Semitism and all these attacks that we've had recently on Jewish cemeteries. You know, there's been tons of them, scores of them lately. I don't know what the hell's going on. But a lot of Jewish people, including my wife, suspect that the president, through Steve Bannon and others, is, you know, kind of dog whistling that anti-Semitism is exaggerated. Anyway, today there was no equivocation. He came out and he condemned it. He called the recent threats against Jewish community centers, the JCCs, of the country horrible and painful. He was made aware of that attack on the Jewish cemetery with the 100 tombstones overturned and all the rest of it. He really rose to the occasion, I thought. And he said the FBI is joining with the Justice Department to investigate possible civil rights violations in connection with these threats to the Jewish community centers across the country. He really came out very strongly to condemn anti-Semitism. But not all Jews were mollified by his statement. Not all Jewish people now feel that, okay, now, as we suspected, he's not an anti-Semite and he's come out and he's condemned this. We're going to stop this new wave of anti-Semitic crimes. We're going to stop this these hate attacks against the Jews. But his statement did not, as I said, did not satisfy many in the Jewish community. A guy named Stephen Goldstein, the executive director of the Anne Frank Center for Mutual Respect, called Trump's statement about the anti-Semitism, called his statement a pathetic asterisk of condescension. He said it was a pathetic asterisk of condescension after weeks in which he and his staff have committed grotesque acts and omissions reflecting anti-Semitism, yet day after day have refused to apologize and correct the record. Wow. Make no mistake, Goldstein writes in his Facebook statement, the anti-Semitism coming out of this administration is the worst we have ever seen from any administration. That, I think, is above and beyond the pale. I mean, that's real. That's, I could get the criticism. But to say it's the worst of any administration? What about FDR? FDR, who wouldn't let the passengers on the damned SS St. Louis, the refugees, 900 Jewish refugees, come ashore in eve of World War II. Wasn't that anti-Semitic? To say that Trump is the most anti-Semitic president ever, or his administration is, I think is ridiculous. And I think that his statements today should put to rest any of the suspicion that Donald Trump is an anti-Semite. He is not. He is not. Thank God he is not. And I think today he eliminated that suspicion, or should have. And I want him to speak about it more. The more he speaks about things like racism and anti-Semitism, the more I like it. You know, let him really put out the message to the United States and to the world that we are the one place on earth where everybody will have their backs covered by the president of the United States. I mean, I want that to happen. I totally believe that Donald Trump is that person. He's not an anti-Semite. I don't think, as I said on the Today Show last Friday, that he has a racist or evil bone in his body, and I think he's unfairly criticized. But, it's his own fault in many ways. He went way too long without speaking out against anti-Semitism. He has now, and that's good. This immigration stuff, though, the immigration rubber hitting the road, is very distressing to me, and I think it's going to add a lot of very emotional vignettes to our public consciousness as we watch and see our authorities rounding up otherwise innocent people who just happen to be in this country without proper documentation and shuffling them off to wherever it is they came from, many of them from crime and violence-riddled areas of Central America like El Salvador and Guatemala and so forth. So my bottom line on this February 21st, 2017, for my friend Donald Trump, bravo on racism. Glad you visited the African-American Museum in D.C. Bravo on anti-Semitism, on immigration. I know you promised it, but it hurts nevertheless, and I think you're going to find the pain is much more apparent than the benefits to the people. That's it. I'm Geraldo. Thanks for listening. See you next time.